Number eight, this is a briefing, priority habitats and species. Tara, I will turn it over to you. After you, we have abalone. I like mine pan-fried.
Good butter.
Good butter.
Oh, no.
I ate some the other day. My friend sent some from Sitka.
Here. This is my first chance to really interact with all of you as a new kid at DFW.
Who are you?
Who am I, Jeff? That's a good question. My name is Tara Rentz. I'm our Ecosystem Services Division Manager within the Habitat Program. And so our shop oversees not only the Priority Habitats and Species Program, which you'll be hearing about today, but also all of our forest practices and forest habitats work, and all of our climate change work and other land use planning all falls within Ecosystem Services. And so I'm part of Jeff Davis's team here within Habitat.
Yeah, good afternoon. I wanted to just maybe kick us off a little bit about my pitch on how typically your workload, from my observations, is talking about allocations or listing or things like that. And I think we're very fortunate as an organization to have a standalone habitat program that works with the other programs that focus on habitat and conservation efforts to ensure that we have a healthy foundation of habitat so that the other programs and your jobs are as easy as they can be given the health of the environment out there that supports these critters. And maybe before we launch into this, the RFEGs are a classic example of how it takes that habitat protection and habitat restoration to really lift the environmental baseline so that we can maybe reverse the trends or keep some of the positive trends going the way they are. I didn't hear a piece in the RFEG presentation about the local jobs that those projects also create. And in the economic downturn, for example, a lot of local contractors were out of business, but for these habitat restoration projects going on, it kept a lot of the local contractors employed. So it's even kind of not just getting the local community together, but also supporting that local community economically. So Tara's amazing. You will see that shortly. We are here to talk about priority habitats and species, but I also, and the role that plays in the department's conservation effort and the partnerships that we have with others, local governments, NGOs, and private property owners in achieving habitat and species conservation. But I also want to make a pitch here. So PHS, I think, historically has been viewed as, that's habitat programs. And then we have the State Wildlife Action Plan. So the program is actually, the agency is actually working across program lines to take a look at the State Wildlife Action Plan, the Priority Habitats and Species Program. And you've probably seen in the Enhanced Conservation Decision Package the term Conservation Priorities Project. And we're committed to continue making progress on that, because that will really be a bridge to modernizing the PHS program, but at the same time making sure that we're incorporating that State Wildlife Action Plan together into one conservation priority program so we can ensure that every program is playing their roles in the implementation of those plans. So we're pretty excited to have the one DFW and get better conservation faster. How about that?
Excellent. Thank you. That's perfect. So with that, we'll dive into it. I keep looking up over at Director Suswin, and he keeps giggling at me. I get really excited about cool projects and cool programs, and I joined the agency in January, and I had the awesome opportunity to inherit some of the coolest programs that I think we do in Habitat. And PHS is one of those examples, and it's kind of an unsung hero for the agency. And so I'm really jazzed to get in front of you guys today and to help you understand how it really is a fundamental component that helps us deliver our mission. And really excited to share with you some of our products that are coming in to that right now that we're working on. And then also give you a little bit of a briefing on something that you have all probably already heard about, which is our riparian guidelines that are being developed through PHS right now. So we should have enough time at the end of this to have some questions, and my hope is this is a teaser for future topics that we can bring in front of you that fall within our shop to help you all connect a little bit better with the work that we're doing. So kind of kicking things off, you know, you hear the term priority habitats and species and our program, and what is it? You know, why do we even care about it? Well, the basic reality is the Priority Habitats and Species Program touches every single thing that we do. It deals with our threatened and endangered species. It helps preserve and protect winter migratory corridors for our game species like mule deer and elk. It protects and conserves shellfish restoration beds and eelgrass, which is important for, you know, for our commercial industry out there. It protects water bodies that have been used for fish stocking, you know, so for our recreational environments. It protects protects and conserves areas that have major aggregations of migratory waterfowl, and it's informed by our science and research that happens throughout the agency every day. So it really truly does touch every single aspect of our agency, from our technology, GIS information and data management, our public relations and outreach, and our science and research. And it connects all of those things through kind of a single delivery portal for our customers and users in the rest of the state. So really kind of, you know, what is PHS and where has it come from? Well, it is our fundamental tool for how we help local governments protect fish and wildlife. And we've been using PHS as a tool to do this for more than 20 years. It was developed in 1990. It was a product originally of the Wildlife Department before the merger. And it was our main way of articulating land use goals and wildlife management goals for land use. It has been integrated when the agency merged, and it is informed collectively by science and research in our wildlife program, science and research in our fisheries program, and through the work that our habitat biologists do every day working with local jurisdictions. And folks use this information to help designate our critical habitat, inform the establishment of fish and wildlife conservation areas. They use it for planning and permitting in all those local jurisdictions. And it's also heavily used not just by local governments, but by our nonprofit partners and others to help inform, you know, mitigation, land acquisition, and other management and restoration activities that they do. So it really is a tool that's used and applied pretty broadly in the state for a lot of different uses. But that, you know, that's kind of where it came from and kind of the core pieces of it. But what PHS really is it is our primary and principal means of providing all of the important information that our awesome employees in this agency collect and do to local governments, state and federal agencies, private landowners, and tribal biologists. This is the way that we deliver the information and work that is collected in the expertise of this agency to folks on the ground to implement land use actions and inform land use actions. So it has huge implications you know, for how conservation rolls out on the ground across the state. My favorite part about PHS, the part that I was the most excited about, is it is one of truly the best examples in this agency of a one DFW model. So this diagram, if you take a look at it, you know, I know you all are very familiar with our game management plans and our sport fish management plans, and those come in front of you fairly regularly. Information from those feeds in through recreationally important species and commercially important species into PHS. And then, as you're also familiar with our State Wildlife Action Plan and our species of greatest conservation need, that information feeds into PHS through threatened and endangered species and sensitive and vulnerable aggregations of species. And then we also factor in things that are of tribal importance. And all of that information collectively helps us determine what is considered a priority species or a priority habitat. And then from those, we're able to develop management recommendations and provide technical assistance and resources to communities to be able to help respond and conserve those needs. And so it's one of these things that PHS is only successful if the rest of the agency is strong and if the rest of the agency is able to to contribute that kind of information into the system so that we can effectively deliver that those outputs to our customers, which primarily in these cases is our local jurisdictions. There's a lot of stuff within the Priority Habitats and Species program. Most people, when they think of it, they just think of our Priority Habitats and Species list or maybe a specific map or GIS tool, but really it's a whole suite of resources. We've got our information and tools. We provide guidelines and advice. We are specifically targeting key species and habitats that are vulnerable to land use change. So not everything is in this. It's not a catch-all bucket. It's very tailored for the needs on the ground. And it requires pretty skillful application. And so it requires a lot of the integration with our habitat biologists to provide technical assistance and other information and a lot of education and outreach to users of this information. So as I'd mentioned, we've got our PHS lists. Those are all criteria-based, as we kind of covered in that one DFW model. Those are some of the characteristics that fit in that allow a critter or a space to get on our PHS list. We have a lot of maps and GIS tools and resources that folks have public access to, including known locations of critters and spaces to be able to preserve and protect those spaces, and also monitoring and adaptive management mapping tools that we'll talk about a little bit later. Another huge component is our management recommendations, so using information and data from across the agency and best available science, we develop habitat-specific and critter-specific management recommendations that can help local planners figure out how to integrate and respond to those species that end up in their landscapes. And then a big piece of what we apply is our PHS technical assistance. So Habitat program is structured in a pretty dynamic way where we have these fantastic, well-trained boots on the ground, our habitat biologists that are located in each of our regions. And those folks are the faces that these local planners interact with on a daily basis and are the ones that are providing the technical assistance to try and make sure the conservation for a specific species or space is able to be accomplished. And so they're really the implementers of PHS. And then finally, we've got our monitoring and adaptive management tools. And so, you know, as we know, as we're looking at trying to deal with spaces of change, and how we preserve and perpetuate our fish and wildlife into the future, we have to be able to provide some tools on monitoring and adaptive management so we can be more responsive as the landscape is changing. So that's kind of really what PHS is, our kind of nuts and bolts getting in there. But more than that, I kind of just want to highlight a couple of really cool products that are in play right now that maybe you've been exposed to. And if not, I totally recommend you dig into our staff a little bit and get exposed to them because they're pretty powerful. The first product I want to introduce you to is this high-resolution change detection maps. So this is something that's actually being done by one of our staff members within our science division within Habitat program. And what this does, if you look at these maps over time, is one of our research scientists, he and his staff identify through aerial photos what a landscape looked like. So you can see the tract of land that's in green, that forested area. And they're actually able to go in there and identify how that landscape and that land chunk has changed over time to evaluate habitat loss, to evaluate has it shifted from a forested area to an agricultural area? Is it now, a neighborhood or a parking lot or things along those lines? Are they things that are natural disturbances or man-made disturbances? And we're actually able to monitor our habitat loss over time through high-resolution change detection. This product was being heavily used by our voluntary stewardship program work that was dealing with agricultural landscapes. And if you've had the opportunity to dig into the governor's budget yet, you might notice under the State Conservation Commission's budget request that we actually were able to secure in the governor's budget full funding for statewide high-resolution change detection maps, which we're super, super stoked about. So hopefully that'll stay all the way through and make it through the system, because this will allow us to provide high-resolution change detection maps over time for the entire state of Washington, which will be actually integrated in most counties' voluntary stewardship plans as they monitor land use change in their agricultural environments. And so it's going to be part of their monitoring and adaptive management programs. And it's a resource that we're going to be able to provide them. So we're very excited about that. It's going to be a lot of work for our team, but they've got some great folks to pull that off. Another thing that you all have probably heard of is our voluntary stewardship program. So if you're not aware, that actually is our interaction in that with DFW is managed through our Priority Habitats and Species program and our section there. And we have an individual that has been serving on that technical panel, and also our habitat biologists have been working in each of these counties to develop those voluntary stewardship plans in each location. And if you're not as familiar with those are plans that are helping to deal with the agricultural environment in each of these counties to ensure that critical spaces and critical habitats are preserved as we maintain and enhance our agricultural viability across the state of Washington. So good news, about 2 weeks ago, the last county's plan was approved. So Spokane County received approval on their voluntary stewardship plan. And all of those counties in Greens are now all the ones that have plans that are in play, and they're all working on their implementation phase. And so our staff are actively working with that, and they utilize the Priority Habitats and Species information to develop those. And then the other thing that we are working on and have been working on for a number of years here is our riparian ecosystems management guidelines. So as I mentioned earlier, one of the many tools that we provide through PHS is habitat-specific and critter-specific management recommendations. And the most recent one that we've been working on is a pretty substantial tome of literature on riparian areas in the state of Washington that consists of both a science synthesis for best available science that our team has developed here, and also a separate volume dealing with management guidelines. So that is a super quick shot on really what PHS is and the role we really play in the agency. And I just kind of want to acknowledge some of the other internal partners within our agency that are actually here with us today. You know, we've got our colleagues with our diversity program. Taylor Cotton's here. I've got Keith Folkerts, who's actually our section manager for Priority Habitats and Species. You know, without our staff inside the habitat program and without our staff in our wildlife and fish programs, I think I've got Eric Netherland back in the back as well. He contributes a lot to this work. It really is an all-agency team effort to make this stuff happen. And so, you know, I just really want to kind of put that out there as a good way to demonstrate the internal collaboration that we're able to do in this agency to really make land use change happen. And so the more we're able to streamline those effects and troubleshoot internal and external barriers, the better we're going to be at delivering some of these opportunities and resources to our partners. And we're pretty jazzed about those internal partnerships that we have. So with that, I will introduce you to what has been taking up my entire life for the last 9 months in this job, which is our Priority Habitats and Species Riparian Guidelines. So as I've already mentioned, we develop these management recommendations for specific habitats, and the objective of those management recommendations is so that local jurisdictions and other partners can understand, A, the best available science surrounding a specific resource, and B, how DFW interprets that science and recommends actions on the ground so that we can help deliver on our mission. You know, we don't have a lot of authorities in the land use spaces, and this is one of the ways and mechanisms that we're able to tap into the work that our partners do across the state of Washington, be they local governments or nonprofit organizations or sister state and federal agencies, to really help us deliver on our mission. And so by providing this information, that allows us to empower our customers a little bit better in this environment. Riparian habitats particularly are important for us. This quote that's at the bottom of the screen there, if you can't read it, it says, "Natural riparian corridors are the most diverse, dynamic, and complex biophysical habitats on the terrestrial portion of the Earth." And essentially, one of the things that our science and research has found is here in the state of Washington, we have something like 85% of our species spend some form of their life stage in the riparian areas. And so as we think about low-hanging fruit for those spaces and places that are kind of one of the best bangs for our buck, yeah, we've got riparian enhancement for salmon, but in addition to improving that environment for salmon, we're able to positively infect a huge proportion of Washington's fish and wildlife, both aquatic and terrestrial, by focusing on conservation in this environment. So it was a really great place for us to start for improving our guidelines. This document is broken into two volumes, and we actually mimicked a technique that Department of Ecology was using with regards to their wetlands guidelines that they were presenting. And the reason why it's broken into two volumes is to very clearly separate the science from DFW's values and our management recommendations. And the reason for that is because depending on the values that a local jurisdiction might have or the other things that they're trying to balance in their area, they may have to do something different than what DFW might recognize, but it still should be informed by the best available science. And so we wanted to make sure that those resources were clearly there. Our second volume in there, Volume 2, contains all of our management recommendations. It was developed as a response to Volume 1, the science synthesis, and it's informed by that. And it's our best professional judgment. It's the advisory and voluntary information we provide to local jurisdictions to help them accomplish their objectives that they have for critical area ordinances and other things. And as a result, they're also kind of our primary audience for what this document's been written for. So before we dive into it, I want to explain a term. We use a term throughout this document, and if you've been talking with partners, you've probably heard the term as well, and it's the term is site potential tree height. And it's kind of a confusing concept if you haven't had the opportunity to work a lot in watersheds. I know when I came to this agency, it was a brand new concept that I had to learn. And I've been trying to figure out the best way to kind of simplify it so that folks understand what we're talking about. Site potential tree height is a fundamental thing that is in our management recommendations, and essentially what it is consider a tree that grows in whatever soil condition. Pick your forested area in Washington State and the soil and temperature conditions that are there. There are specific kinds of trees that grow in that space, and based on the conditions, it can get to a certain height in 200 years. So in this example, this is a tree that grows 160 feet. Theoretically, place that tree at the edge of the stream and knock that sucker over. And that distance is site potential tree height. Now, we're not advocating you take the tree at the edge of the stream and cut it down, but that distance is what's capturing our riparian management zone, and that's a really important term to understand as you start working through our guidelines and are talking to folks. So I'm sure as you can pick up from the definition when we were describing this, that's going to vary depending on where you are in the landscape in Washington. Different places are going to have different biotic functions, different trees that grow there, different growth parameters. And as a result, site potential tree height varies as you move across the state. So this is something that's going to come up as we dive into things. And so I just really wanted to make sure that you all had a good baseline for that term. And hopefully this will make a little bit more sense as we dive through things. I want to briefly just walk through some of the layout that is in some of these documents and the development and public review process that went into some of these things. So our science synthesis chapter is broken down in riparian functions. So there are six chapters, each on different functions in the environment and the science in those. We have identified for the in this document that we didn't call out in our earlier revisions that we have different science and recommendations for non-forested areas like the Columbia Plateau, and so we have a specific chapter on that. We also talk specifically about the importance of watershed management as we're dealing with riparian areas, and then finally some steps to determine site potential tree height. This is the process that we underwent as our team was developing Volume 1. So each chapter was actually written by external and internal experts, topical experts on each of those riparian functions. It underwent a pretty substantial stakeholder and advisory panel process to advise the development of Volume 1, and then actually underwent a pretty robust review from the Washington Academy of Sciences. And so now Volume 1 officially meets the qualifications as a source of best available science in the state of Washington for a number of our things. And we're really, really proud of this document. It had a number of major findings, and we'll just kind of hit a couple of these. A lot of them are no-brainers, that as you'd expect. Riparian areas are critically important. They include things like floodplains and channel migration zones, so channels can walk, and wetlands. The science has indicated that we can delineate riparian areas or riparian management zones by the width equivalent to site potential tree height for a 200-year-old tree in forested regions. And that when we look at historical range of natural variability across the state and manage for that, that it's going to be some of our least risk conditions as we deal with climate change and urban growth and other factors that affect these spaces. And that watershed scale processes are super critical for protection of these functions. So trying to ensure that these riparian areas are healthy and robust and have all of the functions that they need is all very important, particularly for salmon and other things, as you've been hearing throughout many of your presentations, I'm sure. We've also identified that our fish and wildlife populations depend on the complexity and dynamics of these systems, that they do have to be complex and dynamic to be prolific, and that there are a lot of stressors that are impacting these areas, as you guys are all very well aware of, with climate change and population growth. So these are kind of collectively, regardless of the riparian function, some kind of core findings that came out of our science synthesis, and those are used to inform our Volume 2. So Volume 2 is going to be undergoing a lot of changes, but presently the version that is out there is broken down with introductions, with a review of critical area ordinance, regulations, and Growth Management Act. But the meat of it is really in Chapter 3, which is our regulatory tools. We also dive into providing voluntary stewardship and protection and restoration. And then finally wrap things up with a little bit of monitoring and adaptive management and how to build a monitoring and adaptive management program in a local jurisdiction. It underwent a very similar process. The Volume 2 was written by staff, internal experts here within DFW. It had a very extensive stakeholder engagement process. Excuse me. With our sister agencies and with Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission and other major partners. It has been reviewed internally and externally by staff and other experts. And then finally, in May, we underwent a pretty extensive 90-day public comment and review period. And throughout that process, we did additional outreach to key stakeholders like Washington State Association of Counties and others. Thank you, Keith. See, this is why you have great staff, because when you're dying and sound like a crazy person, they bring you water. That's why I'm keeping Keith.
Doesn't fix the crazy.
Doesn't fix the crazy. But at least I don't sound like a frog anymore, which is always a benefit. So once again, we underwent a pretty robust stakeholder process. One of the things I really want to note is these are voluntary guidelines, and as a result, they don't trigger the state environmental, the SEPA process. And so we actually weren't required under any of our laws to undergo public review and public comment. But this was such an important document that we really felt that was critical. And so we not only did we host a public comment period, but we hosted one of the longer comment periods that we tend to do for any of our management recommendations in the agency. So pretty robust, three-month process. Those comments have been received. They're being assessed by our leadership team. And right now we're kind of in this process that's now highlighted in red as we're going back between stakeholders and our staff to try and review and revise that document. So what's changed? You know, what are some elements that have kind of changed not only in our revisions as we're moving forward, but also from these management recommendations versus our original management recommendations in our riparian area in 1997? Well, kind of some core things. First of all, when we first wrote our management recommendations in 1997 to now, we have discovered that there is a lot of new science around healthy riparian areas. They're familiar concepts. They're concepts that for folks who deal with watershed health and management, they've been around for a long time. But there has been hundreds of new studies, analyses, models, and other things that have helped improve our understanding and application of those familiar concepts in the state of Washington. Another fundamental change is historically riparian areas were kind of lumped into buffers around streams. And everyone hears the terms about dumb buffers and like, really, how do you make a smart buffer, right? Well, riparian areas are priority habitats. They, as priority habitats, qualify as critical areas for fish and wildlife. They are more in value than just buffers for streams. And that's one of the ways we're really pushing this in this new document, is recognizing riparian areas for what they are, which is priority habitats, and not just buffers. Since our 1997 guidelines, there's been new language added to the Growth Management Act through Voluntary Stewardship Program, and the terms of no net loss have been included into those laws and policies, and they had shown up earlier than that in Growth Management Hearing Boards and other things, and so we talk about no net loss in this document, and that wasn't something that we talked about in 1997. So those are the big differences between our older version and our new version that we've developed most recently. When it comes to our revisions and how we're responding to the public comments, some of the things that came out is our original push was really highlighting this document for salmon. But realistically, we had some really good terrestrial information that was in our older guidelines that we're going to be bringing up into our new riparian guidelines, so you have a more holistic picture for fish and wildlife. We've also identified that our regulatory mechanisms provide kind of minimum standards. And as you've heard in with the fish habitat enhancement groups and other things, that restoration is critical. And we have an opportunity as an agency to help advise on voluntary restoration activities. And so we're highlighting and strengthening the role of restoration in our revisions that we're working on right now. Another piece that came out is it's really complicated to delineate riparian areas in non-forested regions. Trees make things a lot easier when you're dealing with riparian. We got site potential tree height, but when you're dealing with spaces like the Columbia Plateau and our shrub steppe environments, it's a lot more difficult to try and figure out really where that riparian area ends and how we conserve and protect that. And so we're trying to clarify our management recommendations for how local jurisdictions can work in those spaces to try and conserve those critical habitats as well. And then finally, one of the things that I'm super jazzed about is this is difficult. Site potential tree height is a site-specific thing, and it varies across the landscape. And so when you think about the workload from a county planner's perspective, it's probably pretty hefty to try and figure out how to develop variable regulations. Well, our team here in Keith's shop, and I got to give a shout-out to Terry Johnson, he's one of our GIS gurus, has developed a site potential tree height GIS tool. And it's actually going to be made available with the release of this document, and it will allow local planners to click on the map on a specific parcel level and get a projection based on Natural Resource Conservation Service and Department of Natural Resources soil layers to determine what site potential tree height is in that given location. And so we're trying to arm our county planners with some resources that they need there. And so Terry's been working really hard on cleaning that tool up, and we're really, really excited for that to go live. So that is our riparian document, really in a nutshell. As you can assume, we got a lot of feedback from stakeholders that ranges in the spectrum, and we're working very hard to try and figure out how to resolve a lot of those issues. Our biggest thing that kind of came out of this process is DFW has an opportunity to really say what fish and wildlife need, and to figure out a way how to put that information in a lens so that our customers can really utilize it more effectively. And so we're working very hard in the revision process to hopefully accomplish that goal. And once again, I just kind of want to remind you why this focus on riparian, and it really is because these spaces are one of our best places to move the needle in conservation for fish and wildlife. They create connectivity across our landscapes and movement corridors, north to south, east to west, for aquatic and terrestrial species. They provide critical environments for major life stages for a whole host of critters. I think we're at 160 different fish and wildlife species that are completely dependent for a major stage of their life cycle, fully dependent on riparian areas, and not to mention the other resources they provide for climate, for improving vulnerability in a lot of our local communities, and the recreational and benefits that they help provide in a lot of these spaces as well, providing spaces to hunt and fish and recreate and reconnect people with nature. And then, of course, the primary topic was PHS. And so I just want to remind you again why PHS is so important. And truly, it is this agency's best tool that we have, particularly as we invest in it as a community more, to preserve, protect, and perpetuate fish and wildlife across the state of Washington. So hopefully I have sold you on PHS. Hopefully you are super jazzed to see our next version of the riparian guidelines. I know I am. I wanted them for Christmas, and I'm not getting them. Not getting them for Christmas, but we'll hopefully have those out by early to late spring. And I'm very happy to answer any questions. And if any of these things sparked your interest and you would like future briefings on them or more information on them in the future, we're happy to bring the team down to chat with you. So thank you.
Thank you, Tara.
Can I just say a little bit more? So the preserve, protect, perpetuate, there's the provide commercial and recreational opportunities. There's the conversations we're having about our contribution to the state's economy and outdoor recreation. And then there's the folks that just want to know that their fish and wildlife are receiving proper care, right? Limited professional career here at the department, one thing's pretty obvious. We're not going to be able to achieve our mandate if the public doesn't know information about what's important. And this PHS, and I would say the same for the State Wildlife Action Plan, it's using our biological and scientific expertise to put information in front of people so that it can inform their considerations about their decisions. And I'll give you, and this stuff touches a lot more than you might imagine. I'll give you a real quick example. In my glory days, once upon a time, I got to actually walk in habitat and work on these issues at the ground level. And we had a particular local government that was proposing a high density urban development immediately adjacent to a watershed. And you might go, well, what's the problem? It's in a city. Problem was that watershed had one of the higher bear populations and a pretty decent collection of cougar in that area. And we were going to put an apartment complex immediately adjacent to potentially dangerous wildlife, right? And so our folks are writing letters saying, hey, here's the wildlife and fish information associated in that particular landscape that you're proposing to develop and immediately adjacent. And by the way, at the time, enforcement was responding to dangerous wildlife. And so we're able to write letters on behalf of the whole agency about what the potential effects of that proposal would have on the fish and wildlife populations, in this case, a very economic cost of having to respond to public health and safety issues associated with bears and cougars next to dogs, cats, and children. And so this PHS program is small but pretty mighty, delivered not just by our habitat biologists. Our district wildlife biologists do a pretty good job using this information out there. So it's not insignificant. I know it was a lot of words and a lot of photos, but it really is a powerful conservation tool, because if people don't know about it, then they may not care about it, and they sure as heck won't have it as part of their consideration in making their own decisions.
Thanks, Jeff. And Tara, maybe next time you could have a little bit more enthusiasm.
I'll work on that. I'll be honest, my energy was a little low today. It was, as Kelly will say.
I
it is true.
I can vouch for that.
We heard her exciting story, and I guess I'm going to be Debbie Downer, because I have commercial forest plants.
And we've got cutting permits for the previous probably 25, 30 years. Mm-hmm. And honestly, the last one that I applied for, I really began to wonder if I was going to get it. I mean, it's a no-brainer if it's a perennial stream, let alone a fish-bearing stream. But I can take you in our part of the world and show you streams that run water 3 months a year. And somebody, some genius decided they're fish-bearing streams. Now we have 7,500 foot setbacks on both sides. That's a hell of a financial hit for a landowner. Let alone Hillary France is coming over to have a meet and greet in our county. And one of the things that we're going to discuss with her, it's all well and good when you're here on the west side in a temperate rainforest. But in our part of the world, come August, you're 90 degrees temperature, your 14% humidity, I'll guarantee you, you've never seen a fire till it hits one of those riparian zones that there's been no management in. So instead of going from somewhere with some common sense management to get in there and deal with that, all you have is nothing left. So, no, it's...
Well,
Can I?
Can you?
Go ahead.
Can I please? So, I would say this, Commissioner, you're not on the other side from us. She's not joking when we hear big dumb buffers or riparian buffers. We're very mindful that these are riparian management zones. And so we're on the same page in that leaving these things alone, especially in a degraded state, doesn't get us the fish and wildlife benefits that we're after either. So these shouldn't be thought of, maybe unless you're in the Olympic National Park, as no touch. There's got to be some management in many of our riparian zones to get them to function fully and maximize that. The other thing I'll say is, we should be thinking about all the tools available to help people even want to do this conservation of riparian or riparian management. And that one vehicle is regulatory, that's GMA and SMA, and we should be really mindful of thinking about the incentives, right? So that we don't set a landowner up to, hey, I'm just going to give this away, and I'm going to take economic effects, right? So how can we have some incentives that really bolster up, encourage someone to want to do more than the minimum? So we're not opposite of you. We're right with you on that.
Well, these guys need to hear it, because it's blah blah blah. We're going to save the frickin' world, but I'll guarantee you, when you're on the other side of the coin, it looks altogether different. So there is two sides to this coin. Thank you. Sorry to be Debbie Downer, but
no, I actually really appreciate the points that you raised, and particularly when it comes to, as Jeff was mentioning, hands-off management spaces, and it's particularly as our team is working on forest health issues, that's really huge. The other thing is, we talk about historic ranges of variability. Not every space looked the same across the state of Washington, and as a result, we have very different wildlife needs and environmental needs, and it's important that we're able to manage those spaces for that. You can take just south of us, 25 miles south of us in our Scatter Creek Wildlife Area, where they put forth an alternative forest management plan that abuts the riparian area there to create more of an open oak forested woodland. It's different than what that space was looking like when it had encroachment. And so there's a lot of opportunities, and this is where I would say, this is where our habitat bios shine. To be able to go in with a local landowner and talk to them about their goals and objectives and figure out how to help manage that landscape and help them develop alternative forest practice plans or other building and development plans that can protect the resource, the natural resources and the economic resources. So...
in there, and I hope it conveys down to
me
your people
too.
Because I'll guarantee you right at the moment we're about 180 from there. We get the DNR and the game department working. They're playing good cop, bad cop against you all the time, and yeah, it leaves you a pretty bitter taste in your mouth, trust me.
Mr. Thurber?
Well, I just sort of thinking in my previous life of being a regulator, and how frustrating it was that regulations kind of always feel like one size fits all. And I'm a champion of PHS ever since I discovered it, because I think that it really is a tool that tries to work around that one size fits all. A lot of our wildlife conservation and protection laws and regulations relate to species specific, and I think as wildlife science has moved forward, it's provided us information with how limiting and ineffective a species specific approach is. And Jeff, you started off with, we serve the entire department, the entire state. If we're not able to preserve, protect, and perpetuate these spaces, we're not going to have wildlife. And what I kept hearing that you were emphasizing, Tara, is that these are guidelines. Now, they are sometimes turned into regulations by our local jurisdictions and everything, the critical areas, but these are guidelines, and I really think that it's the contemporary way to go forward with wildlife protection and preservation and conservation. So ever since I discovered PHS, I've been a champion and really appreciate this work. So
I'll invite anybody to come over in about August, and we'll walk out there and I'll show you.
I'm coming in August anyway because I want
to be here. But are considered fish-bearing streams. And we have to be taking care of them that way. And so, I'm here for a reason, so.
Any other comments? Thank you both.
Thank you.